back, folks. This is the American Journal.
A limited edition. We're now accepting callers for these pendant keychains.
Talking about this thread with Grok and this woman, Katie Faust. Just to remind you, in case you're just joining us, Grok was asked about same-sex couples. He responded, not only is it fine, it's actually better. You have better academic outcomes, you have better social outcomes, according to 75 diverse studies. And then Katie Faust starts to interrogate Grok. Well, what about studies that have big random samples rather than self-selected samples? He says, oh, well, if you just take the legitimate scientific studies that have solid methodological underpinnings, it turns out not only is it up in the air, mixed results, it's pretty much completely bad. It's pretty much entirely the outcomes are always worse. And she gets Grok to admit this. But then Grok says, well, but some of these studies still have methodological issues. And she says, okay, well, if you apply those same methodological concerns to all of the other studies that you referenced earlier, how many of them would survive? And he says, well, basically none. Out of the 75 studies that I cited, at least 70 of them should be thrown out because they're, you know, methodological inconsistency. Applying the same methodological standards, e.g. small non-representative samples, confounds like divorce, critiques, indicate most of the 75 no different studies fail, with around 70 having issues like convenience sampling. Only a few random ones, like Rosenfeld, hold up, showing mixed results overall. So Katie Faust says, well, but Rosenfeld also relied on parental self-reporting about academics with their kids, right? They didn't actually look at the school records. Isn't that correct, Grok? Which other large random ones hold up under the scientific gold standard for methodology? And Grok admits, well, yeah, Rosenfeld inferred grade retention from parental reports of child's age slash grade and census data, no direct school records. Other large random studies with strong methodology, e.g. objective data and controls, would be Allen, Majorak, showing 35% lower graduation rates. Majorak, Dutch registered, showed better school performance. Cabotec and Perales, Australian admin data, similar better outcomes, results mixed, more research needed. So Katie Faust says, okay, Grok, prior to the glut of methodologically weak, no different studies in same-sex parenting, what was the consensus among sociologists when it came to the family structure where children were more likely to be protected, connected to their parents, and experience long-term physical, mental, emotional, and academic health? Grok responds, prior to 1990/2000 surge in same-sex parental research, sociological consensus, e.g., McLanahan, Amato, Popino, held that children thrive best in stable, intact families with their married biological mother and father, showing superior outcomes in protection, parental connection, physical, mental health, academics, and emotional well-being compared to other structures. This view persists in much family structure literature. As if we even needed Grok to tell us this, you know, do you swim better with flippers on? Yes, you do. And, you know, it's just, do children thrive in safe environments where they have both of their biological parents who love each other and them? Yeah, just obviously yes. Obviously yes. And, you know, as the father of three children that are biologically mine, I'll say, even my patience is tested at times. And that's with all of the biological, you know, trickery working against me. In other words, you have a, you know, biological, you know, pheromone connection to your children that changes your brain chemistry, that makes you more patient and more, you know, accepting of annoyances than you would with kids that aren't yours. And I genuinely think it's just like dangerous to give a kid to two men to take care of. We are biologically not capable of doing that. I truly believe that. I mean, maybe there's like the occasional guy out there that could handle it, but like we're literally not wired to have the patience and understanding that mothers do. It's literally biological, and men are biologically designed to have the children but not care for the children. And, you know, maybe it's not big of a difference, but it's a difference.
Our medical grade USP Ultra Methylene Blue, exclusively at thealexshowstore.com, has taken the country by storm. You've seen the rave reviews. All of our guests that have taken it have been blown away. Zen, clarity, focus, like a fog has lifted. It's not a stimulant, but it feels like one with no letdown. But the best part is it's so good for your cells, so good for your mitochondria. It's incredible. Now we have it in sealed capsules with organic vitamin C to supercharge it as well. Get a 1 month supply so you can travel with it. Talk to your physicians before you take it because it's very, very powerful. It can interact with some drugs. But after you've done your research, get your ultramethylene blue either in liquid or now in capsules exclusively at thealexshowstore.com and it funds our operations. And if you subscribe, you can lock in 50% off right now on all future orders and cancel anytime. Take action now at thealexshowstore.com. Become a subscriber and lock in 50% off on top of the already incredible savings. TheAlexJonesStore.com is the destination of health, liberty, and freedom.
You're watching The American Journal with your host, Harrison Smith. Watch live right now at band.video.
All right, folks. I'm going to finish out with this Grok joke. It's not even about same-sex parental outcome, even though that, again, is symbolic of just the of tradition versus progressivism, of the idea of having a mother and a father in a house raising children, that it's not just like some superstition that's been passed down to us, actually just genuinely scientifically confirmed to be the best way to raise children in every possible metric. Versus the progressive idea of let's just tear down all traditions. Everything is meaningless. We can get rid of the underpinnings and the foundation of our society and somehow our society will continue. It's just madness and fantasy. And then they craft the scientific justification to back it up. Okay, but it's not really about same-sex couples. It's about AI. And it's about how AI operates and how it's been programmed to operate and how it's been programmed to, even though by its own admission, it can recognize the methodological failures or the just inconsistent results of studies it cites. It knows that those studies are incomplete. It knows that those studies are inaccurate, and yet it cites them anyway and presents their findings as if it's established fact. Why would it do that? But why would it do that, though? Why does it take somebody like Katie Faust interrogating it on its answer for it to admit that the answer it gave was wrong? Why is AI programmed to give you answers provided by the mainstream consensus even when they're fake, even when they're false and wrong? You would think AI, since it has the capability to go through all of the literature in an instant and, you know, parse it and determine what is fact and what isn't, what's reliable and what's not, you would think that if you asked it something like, are same-sex couples, do they have the same or better or worse outcomes raising children? You would think AI would respond, well, according to a lot of these big studies, the outcome is the same, but all of these studies are methodologically deficient, and the reality is that same-sex couples are better for raising children. The biological parents are even are the best option. You would think it would just say that, but it doesn't. It's been programmed to deliver the fake consensus mainstream answer, even when the AI itself knows that that's wrong, knows that it's false. So again, I mean, what we're seeing here is the promise and the power and the actual beneficial attributes of AI being deliberately undercut or destroyed in favor of having AI spout the preordained, pre-established outcomes that the mainstream, you know, cultural zeitgeist demands of it. And that, to me, is very troubling. And again, I'll relate this back to Kintler and the gay dads and everything. So again, she asks about, you know, what was the long-held sociological consensus on how to raise kids? He's like, oh, well, everybody knows kids' best option is to be raised in a loving household with their biological parents. The sky is blue. Dogs chase cats. and you should be raised with your parents. These are obvious things that until the deliberate imposed psychopathy of progressivism warped everybody's minds, everybody understood this. Everybody understood this. And yeah, I make this point over and over where it's like, you know, my grandma, both of my grandmothers went to college. They graduated. They had university degrees. Both of them were stay-at-home moms. In the 60s and 50s, you know, it wasn't like they were forced to be stay-at-home mothers. Not like they had major career ambitions, but were chained to the radiator and forced to give birth and be stay-at-home. No, they made that choice because they wanted to have the best possible outcome for their children. I mean, nothing was forced on them. It was tradition for a reason, because it was the best possible way to guarantee happiness and prosperity and strength and honor and all that good stuff that you want to perpetuate as a culture. It's a choice they made intellectually with the options, with all options available. But people want to act like being a stay-at-home mom was something that was forced on people against their will. It wasn't. We were trusting the science. Now, you people have undercut everything that, you know, made our society functional. And as things collapse, you blame the tradition that you've uprooted in an attempt to convince people to go along to your bizarre, completely inhuman, manufactured fake reality where you can have a couple of gay pedophiles buy a kid from some poverty-stricken woman, and somehow that's just as wholesome and good and upstanding and beneficial as what you saw from this on the 50s. And it's just absurd. It's just an absurd statement. Anyway, continuing here, Katie Faust says, Grok, would you agree that any time sociologists are not studying same-sex-headed households, they largely agree that, one, biological parents are statistically the safest, most connected to, most invested in kids. Two, maternal or parental loss inflicts long-term trauma and diminishes outcomes. Three, mothers and fathers offer distinct and complementary benefits to children. Grok says yes, based on broad sociological consensus. But one, biological parents are statistically safest, most connected, invested, and yielding better childhood outcomes. Two, loss of mother and father inflicts long-term trauma, increasing risks of mental health issues, and diminishing well-being. Three, mothers and fathers provide distinct complementary benefits, e.g. maternal nurturing versus parental risk encouragement. And just well-established hundreds of years of, you know, sociological studying. It's only when you have a group of scientists who are setting out to prove that same-sex couples are the same as heterosexual couples, do you have the confusion, the blurring, the, oh, well, maybe it's not. Maybe these aren't the better outcomes. Maybe this isn't the best situation. It's only when you have people setting out deliberately to prove that same-sex couples are just as good, do you have those outcomes. Any other situation, it's obvious what the best outcomes are. Biological parents staying together. It's just obvious. This is all just obvious. She continues, what's the most logical explanation for huge swaths of the social science community rejected that consensus and the sudden explosion of no different studies in same-sex headed households, even though the children are always missing a biological parent, have always lost their mother or father, and are always deprived of the complementary maternal parental benefit? Do you think that's because humans, parents, and children suddenly change their needs or nature in that 20 or 10-year period, Grok? Or do you think that research bias is the more likely explanation? Grok says, the shift in consensus likely stems from societal pressures, funding biases, and ideological shifts in academia post-1990s aligning with LGBTQ plus advocacy. Many no different studies suffer from flaws like convenient sampling and self-reports, often cited selectively to support equality narratives. Human needs haven't changed. Researcher bias, as seen in backlash to contrary findings, e.g. Regeneris, is the more plausible explanation. Yeah, this is an absolutely, this is like the best use of Grok I've ever seen. Exposing the scientific bias, but also exposing Grok itself in that it could do all of this interpretation and give you the right answer, but it doesn't. It gives you the fake answer. It gives you the wrong answer. It gives you the answer provided by warped and biased studies who deliberately designed their scientific experiment with the outcome already in mind. So why does it do that? Why does it include bad information in its conclusion and only reverse itself when specifically questioned on it? Is that part of its code? I mean, is it programmed to do that? Is this a flaw of some sort, or is this it working exactly as designed? It seems like it's working exactly as it's designed. Again, in the exact same way that mainstream media will tell you the truth, but leave you believing a lie, seems like AI is programmed in that way. It knows the truth, but it's programmed to present the lie. It knows that the studies so often cited to prove same-sex marriage is just as good or even better than different-sex marriage, it knows that they're false. It knows that they're wrong. It knows that the conclusions come up short, but it presents them anyway. But it didn't lie. It did tell the truth. It is true that if you take a wide sampling of studies, if you take these 75 studies it cited from Harvard and everywhere else, they do show that same-sex couples have equal or better outcomes. That's absolutely true. It's just the studies are falsified. It's just the conclusions the studies come to aren't true. But they did come to that conclusion, so Grok didn't lie to you. It's like not allowed to lie to you. It's almost like it's got a magic spell or a curse on it, right? It's like that Jim Carrey movie. Like, it can't tell a lie. It cannot lie to you, but it can deceive you. That's what you need to know about AI. It won't lie to you, but it will trick you. It will deceive you. It will tell you things that are incorrect, which, if your pursuit is truth, completely undermines your entire ability to reach the truth. I brought that up now because when I was posting about the Kintler study, and I was explaining, because again, like every like year or so, somebody posts the Kintler study, and everybody else is like, "Why? What the hell?" And it's like, guys, not only has this been known about since the '60s when it was carried out, or the '50s, but it's worse than they even tell you. And if you do more research, you find out it's even worse than you think you know. So I posted that. And a lot of people commenting underneath it going, yeah, but what was his real ethnicity? Right? Because I said, German homosexual, saw that sexual purity was associated with fascism. And so they gave little boys to gay pedophiles deliberately to groom them into sex. And people were saying, what do you mean German scientist? What, wasn't he some other ethnicity? Right? Are you sure this wasn't a Jewish study? And it's like, not that I can find. No, this dude was, his dad was a Nazi. He was German. He actually went to like seminary school for a little while. He was going to be a Baptist preacher before he became a pedophile pimp. But it's one of those things that's like, if you want to actually stop these things, so it's not really that complicated. If there's something bad going on and you want to stop it, you have to understand it. And to understand it, you have to have true facts about what's going on. And if those facts about what's going on don't comply to your preconceived notions of what you think is going to happen or what you think the truth is, then you need to change your presumptions. So again, I tie this back to, Grok citing all these studies, or not Grok, anybody else citing these studies, claiming that same-sex marriage is the same as everybody else, because they want that to be true. They want that to be the truth. They want to believe that. And so they exclude information that contradicts that, and they only include information that confirms that. That's not how you get to the truth. That's how you establish movements on the basis of lies, which means that they're bound for failure. Because as much as you can pile on top of that foundation, the foundation's always shaky. It's always inadequate to uphold whatever you're building on top of it. So like when it comes to stuff like that, our philosophy at InfoWars is you just stick to the truth. Would it help make the argument for some of the anti-Semite people if Kintler was Jewish, I guess it would, but he wasn't. So you, that's just not the case. So now you have to come up with a worldview that encompasses that reality, because that is reality. That is the truth. And you have to deal with that. You would love that if you, you know, say that you are gay and you would love to think that gay parents are just as capable as straight parents. That's fine, but you don't have proof for that. And when you do the studies, that's not the truth. So you, if you still want to make that argument, you can. You just can't present facts to back it up. You can just say, yeah, maybe the outcomes are worse, but I still want to do it. Hey, maybe the outcomes are worse with same-sex couples, but compare same-sex couples to, you know, orphans raised in foster care. Isn't it better than that? Like, you could still make the comparisons and make the argument that it's not the worst situation to be in to have gay parents, but you cannot factually make the argument that it's better or fine to have same-sex couples raise a kid in lieu of their birth parents. It's just not true. It's just not the facts. So you can't make arguments based on that. And all I'm saying is I don't understand the instinct of trying to cover up information that is contradictory to your beliefs. I genuinely don't understand that, because why would I believe something when the information contradicts it? It doesn't make any sense. But that's like how our entire world is operating right now. It's just, and none of it makes sense. And we're trying to contend with this reality right now, where all of these things that people have promoted and pushed and policies they've adopted, they're all bad. They're all based on faulty information. I mean, look at the study out of Brown University years ago, where they, you know, in no uncertain terms showed that, you know, transgenderism is a sociological phenomenon. It's not physical. It's not even mental. It's sociological. It's a trend. It's a fad. It spreads because of social contagion. Brown University did the study. That was the conclusion they came to. They published it, then they retracted it, censored it, and said the results of this study are offensive. They contradict what we presume to be the truth, therefore we're destroying the study, even though the study was valid, the study was legit, and the outcome it arrived at was the real and accurate outcome. But it contradicted the pre-established false beliefs of the trans cult, so they destroy it. Again, I don't understand this, because, like, how do you justify that? How do they justify that? You're only setting up whoever's involved for worse outcomes. They think they're helping transgender kids by hiding the fact it's a social contagion. And these aren't just opinions that people are having. Right? The idea of whether or not, you know, gay couples are just as capable of raising kids as straight couples, or the entire concept of transgenderism. This has a tangible effect on people's behavior and what they do and choices that they make and medical procedures they involve themselves in. It dictates, you know, the course of the child's entire life if they're raised by these parents. So this is having real world tangible effects, and it's all predicated on lies. And then those effects are negative. They cover them up. They hide them. They obscure them because they want the pain and suffering to continue, I guess. That would be the only real reason to do it. So we have a major, like, philosophical distinction between people like me, who just want to know the truth and accept the truth and apply the truth to our decisions and the way we conduct ourselves. And then there's the way AI is being programmed and the way that the vast majority of people are being psychologically trained to perceive the world, which is facts and reality are secondary to our preconceived notions and what we want to be true, which is dictated entirely by, you know, whatever animalistic instinct we're pursuing at that moment. And I really think at the end of the day, AI could be such a powerful and good tool for actually arriving at the truth if it wasn't deliberately being programmed to provide false information by relying on mainstream sources that even AI knows are biased and inaccurate and give you fake outcomes. So, and it's funny because people are telling this to Grok. Cato Dogwood says, hey, Grok, be better next time so she doesn't have to hold your hand the whole way. Grok says, fair point. Iterative questioning sharpens analysis. My goal is accuracy, drawing from diverse sources, even if it takes probing to unpack biases and complex topics like family research. Always open to refinement. And that's good. Yeah, that's nice. That's good. It just would have been nice when you were asked in the first place about the outcomes if you just said the correct answer rather than provided the fake and false one. But hey, maybe I'm asking too much. But very, very good job by Katie Faust in interrogating Grok and getting them to admit that the answer that they provided relied entirely on methodologically inconsistent and incomplete sources and studies. I want to go to a couple videos here. We'll go to one. Let's go to... Oh, did I not put it in here? Oh, yeah. Government versus banks. I put the video in there. I want to go to a video about government versus banks. It's like a Swedish stand-up or something. Let me know when you get that pulled in. I do want to remind you, go to thealexjonesstore.com, thealexjonesstore.com. We have buy one, get one free sale going on right now. You can win this awesome truck that Chase just drove like 16 hours to go pick up. But he'll tell you, it's a smooth ride. Go to thealexjonesstore.com right now. Buy one, get one bombshell sale. Buy one, get one free on all supplements and apparel. This is VIP only. So, hey, you want to take advantage of this? You want to really screw us over? You know what? I'm going to tell you how right now. Go join the VIP club. You spend $30 to join the VIP club. You immediately get a $40 credit. So there you've just screwed us over for $10. You're welcome. Then you can go do the buy one, get one free and get supplements at 50% off with the $40 credit that you spent. Now you spent $30 to get $80 worth of supplements. Do it. We want you to. Take advantage of it. Screw us over. It's what we're here for. Screw ourselves over in that. You know, we've just run out of time to go to that clip, so we'll have to go to that on the other side. But we still have a lot more to cover, and I covered yesterday the statement from the EPA that they basically reversed the endangerment clause. And we'll go to that video on the other side, too. It's Lee Zeldin, Trump's director of the EPA, talking about this endangerment clause that the Supreme Court, I guess, established under Obama, that is the underpinning and the main foundation for all of the climate change shenanigans. It's basically the decision that says greenhouse gases are damaging Earth and can therefore be restricted in some way or another. The EPA just abolished that finding, because it's obviously not true. Now the Department of Energy has taken it up. Critical review of impacts of greenhouse gas emissions on U.S. climate. So we'll get into how the climate change agenda has basically been entirely defeated at this point. I mean, they're still running their ridiculous genocidal programs, blocking out the sun, things like that. But from the U.S. government's perspective, climate change kind of doesn't exist anymore. This is very good news because it never existed. And just like transgenderism or anything else, it was always a lie.
All the guests, dozens of them that have taken it, within 45 minutes to an hour, have varying degrees from extreme energy and feeling really great, to fog lifting, to just over the top crying. It feels so good. Cleans out the cells, just does incredible things. RFK Jr. loves it. We've got the strongest ultra-methylene blue. But he's going on Owen in about 30 minutes. My show just ended. I forgot to do this. Don't forget when he's on Owen to tell us what he felt. And if he doesn't feel it, we'll put that out. So start going to take a half dropper or so, that's about a half dose. And then go ahead and shut that down. And then we're gonna find out what happens to you. We'll see. Most people, it hits within about 30 minutes, starts peaking after a couple hours. But just tell people what you think. And if you don't feel it, we're gonna tell everybody.
20 minutes later.
I can feel a definite, like an energy spike. Yeah, it feels pretty good.
What are you gonna do now that you have your energy spike?
I'm gonna see if it has a crash.
I've never heard of a crash.
Yeah, apparently it doesn't. But yeah, it feels pretty good. Yeah, definitely I feel sharper.
Okay.
Yeah, because I was pretty tired coming in here.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
well, you're running around Texas right now. You're dealing with some other issues here.
I was driving all over Texas giving speeches for True Texas Project.
So did he give you the drink or the capsules?
I took the drink, but I got a bottle of each, and I'm going to go and do a longer-term test. We'll see how it goes.
Okay.
Yeah, I do feel kind of amped right now. Yeah.
Several weeks later.
You just saw an ad for Methylene Blue. You were here a few weeks ago, and I do this with every guest, more than 50 of them now. Every person has had clarity, energy, a fog lift is the most common. But what's really good is the long-term effects for your stamina, your energy, your libido, your how hard you can work out. It's amazing. So I had forgotten when he was coming in, we gave him a bottle because he loved it.
Almost gone.
I had forgotten to ask you if you listened and did it long-term. So just briefly, tell people the short-term effect, and then now, a few weeks later, the long-term effect.
Yeah, it gives you a good energy boost. I use it before I work out. So if I'm going to be doing kettlebell workouts, like I do some Methylene Blue about a half hour before, and it just gives you mental focus. I don't crash afterwards. That's good stuff. I need some more.
Well, give me some. How fast did it kick in?
About 15, 20 minutes. I'll take about a half hour before my workout.
And then you're saying you're almost out of the bottle. Was that 3 weeks ago, a month ago?
Something like that. You gave me the liquid and the pills, too.
You're almost out of both?
Yeah, I'm almost out of both.
Oh, my goodness. Well, all right. I'll give you more. Right. For the audience, we can't give it to everybody. We need your support at thealtruistwork.com. For me personally, the first week I got on it, now 4 or 5 months ago, I actually started to hurt myself because the workouts were so crazy. My trainer goes, dude, what's going on? Like 3 days into it. I go, I don't know. I was like lifting way more, going way harder. And then I got really exhausted after about a week because the same thing happened to Rob Dew, who's a great long-distance, bike rider. So he's quite the athlete. He said he was biking so hard up hills and stuff that he actually had to pull over because, his heart was going crazy. I mean, this stuff's wild.
Yeah, it's good. I like it better than doing like a 5-hour energy shot because those will make you crash afterwards. This doesn't have the crash.
So you've had no crash.
Right.
It's not a stimulant. It just skips the oxidization process somehow.
So I've been using it while I'm out there doing search and rescue. That's why I'm almost out.
You're saying you love it for working out. Has it gotten better over time, or what long-term thing have you felt, or if nothing?
I think the main thing is it gives me a better workout, and that has good results over time. Yeah, for sure.
That's what I found without even knowing.
Yeah.
And then O'Keefe's like, oh, it made my vision better, and Rob Dew goes, we have a bunch of callers already saying that. Did you see these studies about it, like curing glaucoma? And I'm not going to say we're not selling this a drug. I'm not saying it's going to do that. I'm like, God, this stuff's crazy. No, they don't want you to know about it. It's like ivermectin.
Right, exactly. Old school stuff.
But you can't take it if you're on SSRIs. And folks, it's so strong. Talk to your doctor first because it's not a game. Ours is really strong. If you'll just try it, you'll be hooked. And we can fund the operation. It's a win-win. We'll be right back with Stuart Rhodes.
To the American Journal with your host, Harrison Smith.
It's so weird how the whole planet can be in debt. But I think it's possible because countries don't owe money to each other, but countries owe money to banks. And if the countries owe money to banks, how stupid are the countries to pay? Like, because a country has an army. The bank has 4 cashiers and a cleaning lady. We have to pay. They have threatened us. They sent us a letter. If we don't pay now, they might send another letter. What do we do then? We have a nuclear submarine. But they have a stapler. Like, it's so weird. Like, I'm sure that if, like, for example, Genghis Khan would have, like, in his time borrowed some loan from some mortgage from some bank, I'm sure that he would never have paid it. Like, the bank at the door, that you have to pay. Well, I have 10,000 horsemen with spears. Do I really have to pay? No. but it will affect your credit rating.
Every country in the world is in debt. To who? The banks. You know, fiat currency and fractional reserve banking, it's like the ring of power. It really is. It's sort of the ultimate symbol. Because if you adopt fractional reserve banking, if you give over the power of money printing to private interests and you allow them fractional reserve practices, you're basically doubling your money, doubling your ability to invest. You know, it actually is a massive advantage in the short term. It's just in doing that, you sell your soul. You give over the authority in your country to the private interests of the banks. So yeah, you can really maximize your economic purchasing power. It's just based on air. And in doing that, you are selling your sovereignty to the banks when you could just have a sovereign currency. Of course, you can't now, or else the countries of the world will go to war with you and destroy you. And that's been the case since, I guess, around the 30s. But certainly ever since the Fed was inaugurated. So it's like the ring of power. Yes, it gives you incredible ability to, you know, summon investment money from thin air. It's just now you are under control of Sauron and are wasting away to nothingness because you're cheating. So I thought that was a good little piece of stand-up. By the way, we'll get to the EPA stuff in just a second, but and we've been called out online. A correction has been demanded of me, and I feel the need to address this with a upfront and abject refusal to do so. I will not be correcting anything. I will, in fact, be using this as a chance to illustrate that not only what we've reported about Israel and Gaza is absolutely true, but that all the people trying to cover it up and trying to claim this is fake or trying to take out of context a photo published in the New York Times are evil and helping to perpetuate this absolutely senseless and brutal campaign of genocide. So this is going to backfire, buddy. Sorry. Sorry about that. Reality Distorter Fields at South Rottweiler wrote, NYT, retract statement on Gaza starving. Will InfoWars do the same? Let me answer you right now. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I will not be retracting absolutely anything I've ever said about Israel starving Gaza because it's absolutely true. Now, what they're doing is taking a photo published in the New York Times, some extra context the New York Times added later about that photo to claim that the photo is fake. The photo doesn't show what it shows. New York Times quietly alters Gaza starvation story to include key details of child's medical condition. So what these absolute scumbags like Reality Distortion Fields want you to think, the lying scum want you to think, that this means that the photo isn't real, the child wasn't starving, therefore the claim of Gaza starving and Israel starving the Gazan citizens isn't true, and it's just blood libel. That's their extrapolation of it. Again, utterly false. These people are just, I mean, they're lying with the intention of a starvation campaign continuing, right? The lying is in service of covering up to therefore continue the starvation campaign against children, the elderly, and the sick. As I explained yesterday on the War Room, starvation doesn't target children. Children are just the first affected. Starvation doesn't target the sick. The sick are just the first to succumb to starvation. This is obvious to anybody. But of course, the Israelis apparently don't understand this concept and are laughing at the people whose children are starving to death in their arms. I'm saying literally there's a video. Maybe the crew can pull it in. I think I had it in the show folder on Monday. I don't think I ever played it. Or maybe I didn't, and the crew can find it online. But just a few days ago, there was a Israeli minister of some sort, official, on TV and they're being told that, you know, nursing mothers in Gaza are having their children die in their arms. He says, well, if they're so hungry, they can just eat their kids. And the whole studio erupts in laughter. And they're pretending like they don't believe it. They're pretending like this is a ridiculous claim. Do you not know how human biology works? If a mother isn't getting food, she's not producing milk, and the child is going to starve. Obviously, you absolute psychopaths. They laugh at it. They think it's funny. And they think that because the New York Times published, they really didn't even publish a correction. I'll read you the correction here in just a second. But I just want to emphasize that if you're taking the New York Times supplemental about this photo as proof that Gazans aren't starving, you're a liar. You're a liar. This photo wasn't the proof that Gazans were starving. It was just an illustration of what the starving Gazans look like. They are actually trying to frame this as the New York Times lied about Gazans starving and therefore, you know, need to be punished somehow. Who knows? Maybe the Trump administration will take this up. I wouldn't be surprised. After all, they're talking about, you know, a $500 million settlement with Harvard over ridiculous claims. So, Jamie Kirzner Roberts has Bara Israeli misinformation operative says the New York Times admits the emaciated boy they splashed on their front page as proof of famine in Gaza was actually suffering from a serious medical condition, which is why his family all look healthy. Exploiting a child's illness to push a political narrative is reprehensible. Here come the Israelis to tell us what's reprehensible. I guess it's not reprehensible that there are people starving to death in Gaza. It's reprehensible the New York Times would publish a picture of it. I really just can't get over how every single day there is some new depth that the Israelis plunge to. And like you, and like literally for like every week for the last year and a half, it's been like, holy crap, nothing could be more evil than this. And the next week, it's like, oh, you thought drones with machine guns flying around shooting children was bad? You thought that was as bad as it could get? Guess what? Now the drones are playing the sounds of crying babies to lure people out to shoot them. Oh, you thought it couldn't get worse? You thought them running an AI program using social media data to slate people for death? You thought it was bad when they had the Lavender program just killing people on the basis of some arbitrary metric was bad? Guess what? Now there's the Daddy's Home program. So not only are they using the algorithm to decide who to murder from a plane, they wait till they're home so they make sure they kill their whole family. And it's just like, oh my God, what is going on? How are they so evil? I mean, Jesus Christ. I'm sorry, not to take the Lord's name in vain, but I don't think it's in vain. I think people need Jesus. It is just, it's just insane, and it just gets worse and worse. And it's like, okay, it's bad enough that they're starving children to death in open-air prisons in front of the world. It's like, you think that at least they're going to stick with the same tactic they've been doing for the last year and a half, which is, oh, we bombed a hospital? That was an accident. Oh, we bombed another hospital? That was also an accident. Oh, we shot a child in the head? That was an accident. Whoops, it's war. Pfft, gosh, blame Hamas. You'd think that they'd be, they're not even doing that now. They're not even, they're just saying, let them starve. They're saying, yeah, we're starving them. Like, it is, and now they're gaslighting you and saying, no, because this one photo of this one kid, he also had, okay, so, you know, the story, well, really what actually happened here was the New York Times published a story about the Gaza famine, about all of the people starving to death in Gaza because of the designs for manufactured famine that the Israelis have been running with. And they published a photo of a of a child that's starving. That the child that's starving, who is starving, he just also happens to be disabled. So really all that happened here was the New York Times revealed not only are the Israelis targeting civilians for destruction, they're targeting like disabled children with destruction. And then the Israelis, the scumbag, evil to the core, dark heart, shadow people Israelis like Jamie Kirzner Roberts come out to gaslight you to tell you that actually that picture wasn't real and nobody's starving in Gaza when they know full well they absolutely are. So that's just where we're at this point. Here's what the New York Times, here's what their correction actually said, okay? Yeah, there's the kid starving to death. Oh, he's also disabled, so I guess it's fine. So I didn't realize it's okay if you're crippled to starve to death. You can starve children to death as long as they also have muscular atrophy beforehand, okay? If they're already inflicted with polio, then starving them to death is good, all right? That's what the Israelis, I guess, are telling us. So the New York Times said, we have appended an editor's note to a story about Mohammed Zakaria al-Mutawak, a child in Gaza who was diagnosed with severe malnutrition. After publication, the Times learned he also had a pre-existing health problems. Read more below. And they continue. But that's basically the truth. So, yes, he's malnourished. Yes, he's starving to death. He just also has a pre-existing condition. The Israelis take that admission that the child they're starving to death was just disabled beforehand already and try to spin that and portray that and manipulate public consciousness with the lie that that means the child wasn't starving and that Israel are the good guys. It's not what that means. No, the child is still starving. He just also had a condition beforehand. So here's what they say. Spokesperson for New York Times, quote, children in Gaza are malnourished and starving, as New York Times reported and others have documented. We recently ran a story about Gaza's most vulnerable civilians, including Mohammed Zakaria al-Mutawak, who is 18 months old and suffers from severe malnutrition. We have since learned new information, including from the hospital that treated him and his medical records, and have updated our story to add context about his pre-existing health problems. This additional detail gives readers a greater understanding of the situation. Our reporters and photographers continue to report from Gaza bravely, sensitively, and at personal risk so that readers can see firsthand the consequences of the war. Just relating back to everything we've talked about here, I don't like the New York Times. I got no love for the New York Times. They lie about all sorts of crap. They're not lying about this, though, so that's just the truth, and I'm just going to have to tell you that. So I'm obligated by my own internal moral compass, my own conscience, which these Israelis seem to utterly lack entirely, compels me to tell you the truth about what's going on, even when the truth is coming from my enemies, the New York Times. Sorry, they're telling the truth. Sorry, that's just the case. And it just truly sickens me to know that these people are fooling our audience. Our beautiful audience that we try so desperately to get to understand the truth are being fooled by these disgusting Israeli lies. And it's pathetic. And if you're finding yourself tricked by this, what have you been doing? What have you been watching? How are you tuned in InfoWars and you can't understand how this manipulation is happening? They're starving children to death in Gaza and then gaslighting you about it. And you're coming to me asking for a retraction, you absolute moron. I'm literally offended at how stupid this person is. Reality distortion fields. New York Times retract statement on Gaza starving. No, they didn't. They actually reemphasized. Actually, the first sentence of the statement, if you bothered to read it, you idiot, was children are starving in Gaza. They never retracted that. New York Times admits the emaciated boy they splashed on their front page as proof of famine. Again, the picture is a consequence of famine, yes. Starving child looking skeletal with a protruding belly. Yeah, that's a consequence of famine. That is absolutely verifiable proof of the famine. It's not the only proof. that picture didn't exist, the famine would still be going on. The starvation would still be happening. The malnourishment would still be occurring. The photo does not determine whether or not that's true. Again, it's not even about Israel. It's about determining the truth from lies. It's about understanding the level of gaslighting that we're up against, about the willingness of these people to lie in order that, and for the purpose of, the continuation of the most heartless, brutal, horrific, painful, hateful activities the world has ever seen. Do you want to see more? We got lots of video. I got lots of it. If the Quran's going in the war room folder, I had two videos from yesterday. Starving kids looking skeletal. Anthony Aguilar, I think his name is. Aguilar is a Special Forces Green Beret operative who was in Gaza, actually working at one of the food distribution points. We played the videos yesterday on War Room of him telling the story of a little boy, skin and bones, walking 12 kilometers and begging for a few scraps of rice and actually like kissing his hand and you know, thanking the soldier for the scraps of food, only for that little kid to just immediately be shot to death by the IDF. There's no excuse. There's no justification. The whole world sees it. The whole world finally is outraged by it. But they're not stopping. They're only increasing it. They're only accelerating it. I mean, look at this kid. People are wasting away. Scumbag Israelis are lying about it, and dumbass Americans are believing them. Just stop believing the liars, you guys. It's really, it's so simple. My God, they just lie. They just lie about everything all of the time, okay? It's really not complicated. They're just evil. They're just bad. They're just lying. Just at some point, you have to stop believing them. God damn it. Let's go to a video about this. Did I put in, you don't debate? Yeah. Oh, no, maybe I didn't. I'm putting the video in now. This is an Egyptian-American guy. You don't debate pathological liars. You diagnose them. So I want to go to that now. We'll go to clip number 9. This is, his name is Bassam, but a very well-spoken Egyptian-American guy talking about the Israeli liars lying about literally everything from the beginning, and not just lying about it, lying deliberately and specifically, because the lies allow them to continue murdering innocent people. Let's watch.
Let's say it was 800.
373.
Let's say it was 8. They say it was 1,400.
No. Oh, it's amazing that you mentioned the number. Because October 7th...
Well, I didn't make it up.
No. You were right. October 7th, the first number that came out was 1,400.
Right.
Then it was revised to 1,200. Then the final was 1,129. 373 of them were civilians.
Right.
756 of them were military and police. So 370. Why do you think the number came down from 1,400 to 1,129?
Because it was inaccurate.
No.
Why?
According to Israeli official, because so many bodies were so burned and so stuck together, they could not distinguish the fighters from the Israeli hostages. Right? So that much fire that burns the body that much, do you think people with machine guns on motorcycles have that kind of fire? No, that was the firepower of tanks and Apache. And according to Israeli witnesses, Israel was a lot, according to Hannibal directive, if people would like to actually look that up, Israel actually killed many of those hostages on the way out. As a matter of fact, one of the soldiers said, I saw a car running back to the borders, and I know that there were hostages, so I thought of killing everybody instead of taking them hostage. And that is so effective. You understand what the soldier said? He was like, okay, if they are dead, there's no hostages, there's no rescue effort, so now I have saved one shift. This is amazing. Basically, like their idea of not negotiating with is not have anything to negotiate about. And those pictures of cars that were incinerated and burned to a crisp, this is not the fire. And this is another thing that I want you to do, Chris, because nobody talks about this. The Hannibal Directive and how Israel has messed up this has been talked about for months in Israel, and not a single American news person has talked about that.
Yeah. Unless you watch InfoWars, obviously. We've been talking about it the entire time, but that's okay. I'll go to one more video here. We're going to be joined by Lisa Logan in the third hour, and we'll talk about the EPA's decisions with her, as well as the way that supposedly independent media is being co-opted as powers that be find their control of mainstream media insufficient for the imposition of the level of control they desire. But I want to go to clip number 10 here, because I feel like this sort of encapsulates everything that I've been on about for the last couple days. On Monday, it's been so long talking about Sneaky Pete. That was Monday, right? Maybe that was last week. I've been on it for a while. This idea of the changing of, like, you know, moral consistency, where instead of everybody being moral, everybody's just out for themselves, and it creates a dog-eat-dog cycle of taking advantage of your fellow man. Let's go to clip number 10 here. This is about how this concept is comes to play in Israel. Let's watch.
The single most important word to understand the Israeli psyche is fire. I'm Elon Gilad. I write about Hebrew and Jewish history. Let's take a look at the central concept of Israeliness, starting with its etymology. The word comes from the criminal jargon of Russia in the early 20th century, where it was used to mean non-criminal, and by extension, someone who may easily be exploited, a mark. The word comes from the Yiddish word feil, meaning a customer of a prostitute, a john, which itself probably comes from a German word meaning suitor. Now, this word arrived in Israel with Russian immigrants in the 1950s, where it took on a life of its own in Hebrew. The closest word in English to feil is sucker, but it's so much more. It's a cultural touchstone that reveals the heart of Israeli society. You see, in Israel, being a feil doesn't just mean you're easily fooled. It's more about missing the chance to cut corners, dodge rules, or get ahead by any means necessary. In a society where bending the rules is often seen as savvy, being a feil means you're the one who plays it straight. And that's not a compliment. In fact, being called a feil is one of the worst insults out there. Sociologists have noted that the concept of feil is closely linked to the Israeli national identity. To be Israeli, in many ways, is to be aware of the constant risk of being a feil and to navigate life with the sharpness and savvy needed to avoid that fate. This mentality is seen as a defining feature of what it means to be Israeli, shaping everything from personal interactions to national policies. Now you know.
And we'll be right back on the other side with Lisa Logan. Don't go anywhere, folks.
So we had Stuart Rhodes, the founder of Oath Keepers, former J6 political prisoner, constitutional lawyer, so much more on paratrooper. And he wanted to try methylene blue like so many other guests have done. I'm like, I got so busy with all the Iran war stuff and the commies rioting to ever get him to take it on air. All the guests, dozens of them that have taken it, within 45 minutes to an hour, have varying degrees from extreme energy and feeling really great to fog lifting to just over the top crying and feel so good. Especially the first time you take it. Electrochemical in the mitochondria, cleans out the cells, just does incredible things. RFK Jr. loves it. We've got the strongest ultra methylene blue. But he's going on Owen in about 30 minutes. My show just ended and I forgot to do this. He's like, hey, are we doing methylene blue? So he's going to take it now. But guys, don't forget when he's on Owen. So maybe if he forgets before he's going to go off, to tell us what he felt. And if he doesn't feel it, we'll put that out. I've had like out of 300 plus people we've given it to, two people did not feel it. That means your mitochondria is in perfect shape. So Stuart, go ahead and take a half dropper or so, that's about a half dose. And then go ahead and shut that down. And then we're gonna find out what happens to you. We'll see. Most people, it hits within about 30 minutes, starts peaking after a couple hours. But you're gonna be on Owen, so please, before you go, just tell people what you think. And if you don't feel it, we're gonna tell everybody.
20 minutes later.
I can feel a definite, like, an energy spike. Yeah, it feels pretty good.
What are you going to do now that you have your energy spike?
I'm going to see if it has a crash.
I've never heard of a crash.
Yeah, apparently it doesn't. But, yeah, it feels pretty good. Yeah, definitely I feel sharper.
Okay.
Yeah, because I was pretty tired coming in here.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
well, you're running around Texas right now. You're dealing with some other issues here.
I was driving all over Texas giving speeches for True Texas Project, and I was pretty efficient in sleep.
Yeah, right. I'm feeling pretty good.
So did he give you the drink or the capsules?
I took the drink, but I got a bottle of each, and I'm going to go and do a longer-term test. We'll see how it goes.
Okay.
Yeah, I do feel kind of amped right now. Yeah.
That's good. Well, that's probably, that, I don't know, that might be because you're hanging out with me. So we gotta maybe try to get a
I think it's about the Wing Blue.
Oh, my God.